I call Senate Resources to order. Today is Friday, March 28th, 2014. Let the record reflect, it is 3:34 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Fairclough and Senator Machicki. I believe Senator Bishop is on his way shortly. Excused today, Senator McGuire and Senator Dyson. Recording secretary is Ann Krekelberg. The audio is Claire Gross, and my staff, Lindsay Williams, is keeping us in order here. So earlier this week, we heard from 12 different user groups and stakeholders in the Upper Cook Inlet. Today, we're going to hear an overview of the salmon stocks and management plans in the Upper Cook Inlet from ADF&G, Department of Fish and Game. So presenting today is Charlie Swanton, Director of Sport Fish Division, and Tracy Lignaw, Regional Supervisor for Central Region. On the phone is Jeff Regnart and Bill Templin, also with Fish and Game, and they're available, I guess, as lifelines for you guys. So welcome. I'll let you put yourself on the record and present your PowerPoint. Just FYI, we do have a little screen down here. Even though we're sitting up here, we can still see what you're showing on the screen. So. But welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and members of the Senate Resources Committee. My name is Charlie Swanton. I'm the Director of Sport Fisheries, and with me to my left is Tracy Lingnow. He's the Regional Supervisor for Region 2 Commercial Fisheries. Together, we will present to you an overview of Upper Cook Inlet salmon management and the management plans governing these fisheries. The purpose of this presentation is to describe to you some of the geography of Upper Cook Inlet, the stocks of salmon that run through Upper Cook Inlet, and the management plans which guide the harvest and allocation of those stocks, and how those management plans interrelate to each other into the various stocks.
Thank you, Tracy Lingnow, for the record. Upper Cook Inlet is managed into two distinct areas. The Northern District, with its southern boundary between Boulder Point on the east side and to a coordinate on the west side. The Central District's northern boundary is out of a line of a boulder point, and its southern boundary is at the anchor point latitude. All five species of salmon are found in Upper Cook Inlet. Drainage that support these species are the Susitna River drainage, which includes the Yentner River, and then to the east in the Northern District includes the Little Susitna River and the Kinnick and Turnagain Arms. The largest sockeye salmon producers in Cook Inlet are the Kenai and Kisilof Rivers. Systems to the west and north include Theodore, Chewidna, Beluga, and Lewis. And then to the south and west is Crescent, Drift, and Custatan Rivers. Only set gill nets are allowed in the Northern District, and in the Central District fishery, both drift and set gill nets are allowed. Another term commonly used are references to the various fishing sections that have been developed by the Board of Fisheries through time. The Kenai and Kisilof sections were adopted in 1996 at the Upper Cook Inlet Board meeting, and more recently, the Kenai and Kisilof expanded sections were developed. And then just this past February, at the last Upper Cook Inlet Board meeting, an Anchor Point section was developed. These selections are used to harvest Kenai and or Kisilof River sockeye salmon while allowing northern bound stocks to move through to their drainages.
Cook Inlet is one of the most complex salmon fisheries in the state. There are a suite of management plans that were addressed at the recent February 2014 Upper Cook Inlet Board meeting. These plans include subsistence fisheries in Tionic and the Upper Yentner River, personal use fisheries in the Kenai, Kisilof, Beluga, and Fish Creeks, sport and guided sport fishing, and set and drift gill net commercial fishing. There were approximately 236 proposals at the Upper Cook Inlet Board meeting in February. In-depth information for each proposal was available prior to and at the board meeting. To begin with, the Upper Cook Inlet Salmon Management Plan is the umbrella plan that covers all of Cook Inlet. It was first adopted in 1977 and has been in place for over 30 years, and it has been reviewed at every board meeting since. This umbrella plan guides the harvest and allocation of stocks through a series of step-down plans. Examples of step-down plans are the Kenai River Late Run Sockeye Salmon Management Plan, the Central District Gillnet Fishery Management Plan, and the Kenai River Late Run King Salmon Management Plan. These step-down plans provide specific directives to the Department for In-Season Management of the various resources, and they often lay out the allocation of the resource. These plans are structured around the migratory timing of the various salmon stocks as they move through Cook Inlet.
The bars displayed here reflect the general run timing of these stocks as they move through Upper Cook Inlet. The early sockeye and early king salmon runs in May and early June are fairly well separated from the other stocks as far as run timing. This is followed by a mixture of late run sockeye, late run king, early coho, pink, and chum salmon that all come in late June and through early August. They all overlap in run timing, and many of these follow the same migratory pathways. It is this late June and July time period when the bulk of the management challenges lie in front of us in Upper Cook Inlet. This slide incorporates the various management plans into the run timing of the salmon stocks. There are a total of 17 different management plans. The plans listed here do not include other guidelines such as gear, bag limits, seasons, and other. Three of these step-down plans cover the entire season. These relate to Cook Inlet subsistence fisheries, Upper Cook Inlet personal use management plan, and the riparian habitat plan. Here you see the list of the plans that are active during the early portions of the Upper Cook Inlet runs, followed by the largest number of plans that go into effect during the middle portion of the run. Then at last, those fisheries that are later in the season and those plans that govern them. Most of Upper Cook Inlet is designated as a non-subsistence area. However, there are two subsistence fisheries. The Tionic, which is aimed at king salmon by using set gill nets. Then another subsistence fishery for sockeye salmon, which folks use fish wheels with a live box.
Although the personal use salmon management plan overlaps all the time frames, its emphasis is during July when Kasilof sockeye and late run Kenai sockeye migrate into the inlet. These fisheries began in 1982 and have evolved from subsistence fisheries that were in place prior to the designation of non-subsistence use areas in 1992. There is one personal use fishery at the mouth of the Kasilof that uses set gill nets to target Kasilof sockeye, but most of the opportunity provided in personal use fisheries is in the two dip net fisheries, one at the mouth of the Kasilof and one at the mouth of the Kenai River. There are two additional personal use fisheries that are quite a bit smaller, a dip net fishery in Fish Creek near Wasilla and a second on the Beluga River, open only to senior citizens. We also have riparian habitat plans. The riparian zone is a vegetative zone along the banks of the river and provides important rearing areas for juvenile salmon. While the plan covers the entire year, there is an emphasis in the middle time frame in July because of the intensive in-river usage during that time period. The primary objective of this plan is to be able to regulate in-river fisheries to protect riparian habitat. Most of the assessment and application occurs during the late run Kenai River fisheries. Plans prior to July 1 include the Northern District King Salmon Plan, the Kenai Kasilof Early Run King Salmon Plan, the Big River Sockeye Plan, and the Upper Cook Inlet Marine Early Run King Salmon Plan. There is also the Russian River Sockeye Plan, which actually covers the whole season but contains an early part for the early Russian River sockeye run, and a later part that covers the late run sockeye run. Most of the stocks prior to July 1 are managed primarily for recreational purposes. During the early time frame, there are freshwater fisheries for king salmon and a sport fishery targeting early run Russian River sockeye. Also during this time frame in the Northern District, there is a commercial king salmon fishery. And on the west side of Cook Inlet, a sockeye salmon commercial fishery.
The Northern District King Salmon Management Plan addresses management of the directed king salmon fishery that occurs in the Northern District. This opens on the first Monday on or after May 25th and goes through June 24. Depending on the calendar year, there are between 4 and 5 commercial periods during this time frame. Each of these commercial periods is 12 hours long. However, in recent years, because of the poor king salmon runs, there have been substantial restrictions to both commercial and sport fisheries in the Northern District and its drainages. The Kenai River and Kasilof River early run king salmon plan is designed to ensure adequate escapement and conserve the unique large-sized Kenai River kings. It primarily governs the sport fishery harvest because there is little or no commercial fishing on these stocks. The plan contains size limits on the king salmon anglers that can be harvested on the Kenai River, and provides options managers can choose from to restrict these fisheries if necessary. There's a Big River sockeye salmon plan that addresses a commercial fishery on the west side of Cook Inlet in the Custatan Subdistrict and also on the west side of Calgon Island. The Upper Cook Inlet Saltwater Early Run King Salmon Management Plan is meant to stabilize the sport fish harvest of early run king salmon in the mixed stock marine fishery. These are waters near Deep Creek and Anchor Point. The plan establishes closed waters near the mouths of local streams. It sets and establishes guideline harvest level for sport harvest. And finally, the Russian River Sockeye Salmon Management Plan is to ensure adequate escapement and provide for management guidelines to preclude allocation effects. The early run is harvested primarily in the sport fishery. The late run is harvested by sport, but also by commercial and personal use fishermen. The plan for the late run Russian River Sockeye provides options for restricting the in-river fishery, but specifies that the least restrictive option should be used early to avoid the necessity for more restrictive and complete closures later in the season.
The Board of Fisheries, through implementation of the Sustainable Salmon Fisheries Management Policy, have designated 7 Northern Cook Inlet king salmon stocks as stocks of concern. There are the Chuitna, the Theodore, the Lewis, Alexander Creek, Willow, Sheep, and Goose Creeks. This table is an update that summarizes recent escapements to each of the king salmon stocks currently designated as a stock of concern. Escapements have been low each of the last 5 years, and only in 2013 did 2 stocks, the Chuitna and Willow Creek, meet their escapement. 11 of 16 Northern Cook Inlet king salmon escapement goals were achieved in 2013. Which is a significant improvement upon previous years.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are we asking questions at the end? Or? The
presenters asked if we could wait till the end to ask questions.
I will wait till the end then. Thank
you.
In the middle time period, primarily in July, you have the largest number of management plans. Highlights of these plans are sockeye, chum, and pink salmon stocks that move through Upper Cook Inlet during this time period and are managed primarily for commercial uses. The Kenai River late-run king salmon stocks are managed primarily for sport and guided uses. Also, minimizing the incidental take of the Northern District Coho, late-run Kenai Kings, and Kenai River Coho in the commercial fisheries. The major fisheries occurring during this time period include commercial, personal use, sport, and guided sport. The Kasilof River Salmon Management Plan governs the harvest of Kasilof River sockeye salmon. Part of this plan states that achieving the lower end of the Kenai River escapement goal takes precedent over not exceeding the upper end of the optimum escapement goal in the Kasilof River. What this means is that 50,000 additional sockeye salmon may escape into the Kasilof River in order to ensure that the lower end of the escapement goal is met in the Kenai River. This fishery opens on or after June 25. However, it may also open as early as June 20, based on a 50,000 sockeye salmon trigger. From the beginning of the fishery through July 7, there are 48 hours of additional fishing time per week beyond the regularly scheduled 12-hour fishing periods. Fishing is also closed for 36 consecutive hours per week beginning sometime between 7 p.m. Thursday night and 7 a.m. Friday morning. There's also a terminal harvest area which encompasses the mouth of the Kasilof River. This has been used when Kasilof River is going to exceed its escapement goal, and all other management tools have been used to control the escapement. After July 7, the Kasilof River sockeye management plan is married to the late run Kenai River salmon sockeye management plan.
The Kenai River late run king salmon management plan provides for adequate escapement of late run king salmon. This plan directs the department to manage the stock primarily for sport and guided sport uses in order to provide sport and guided sport fishermen with a reasonable opportunity to harvest these salmon over the entire run. This plan includes direction on managing both sport and commercial fisheries. Pre-season or in-season actions are to be taken based on projecting the in-river run and whether or not the escapement goal will be achieved. Unlike the Kenai River late run sockeye salmon management plan, the run projection is not specifically tied to the sonar project, so all available information is used in developing the projected return, including creel surveys, in-river test netting, and commercial set net harvests. The plan also states that if the in-river sport fishery is closed, the marine sport fishery off of Deep Creek and a commercial set net fishery are also closed. If the in-river sport fishery remains open but is restricted to no bait, the commercial fishery would remain open but also be restricted. And finally, the plan also provides direction to the department to conduct habitat assessments as feasible and report findings during the normal board cycle.
At the recent Upper Cook Inlet board meeting just this past February in 2014, there were new regulations passed pertaining as to how the east side set gillnet fishery would be fished in years with low runs of king salmon. These plans would be implemented together beginning July 1, and they are paired with sport fish restrictions. If less than 15,000 kings are being projected, then the sport fisheries in the Kenai River and in the saltwater are closed to the taking of king salmon. The Eastside Set Gillnet commercial fishery is also closed, and no drift fishing may occur within 1 1/2 miles of shoreline. When the projected escapement is between 15,000 and 22,500, and the sport fishery is allowed to continue but no retention now, meaning catch and release, then only 12 hours of set gillnet commercial fishing per week is allowed in the Eastside Set Gillnet fishery. If the sport fishery is limited to no bait, essentially reducing the harvest by 50%, then no more than 36 hours can be used in the Eastside Set Gillnet fishery. The board also stipulated that after August 1, commercial fishing could not occur, or could only occur, if the escapement goal is projected to be greater than 16,500 fish. In addition, step-down plans passed in February in the commercial fishery during times of low king salmon abundance, the department can reduce the number of nets being used. Typically, there are three nets used by the set gillnet fleet, but now the department can require less than three nets. Also, a significant change in the history of the set gillnet fishery in 2014 is the incorporation of the 29 mesh deep gill nets. Typically, fishermen use 45 mesh deep nets, but there have been a few that are starting to use 29 mesh deep nets. The Kenai River late run sockeye plan, which is separate from the plan that I just described, is one of the more complex plans. This plan goes into effect on July 8, and as I mentioned before earlier, also includes the Kasilof section. It directs the department to manage the late-run sockeye primarily for commercial uses, but yet minimize the harvest of Northern District Coho, late-run Kenai River king salmon, as well as Coho salmon moving into that area. Windows of closed fishing also provide for personal use and sport fishing opportunities. Management objectives specified are to meet the optimum escapement goal, which is 700,000 to 1.4 million sockeye salmon, and to achieve in-river goals. In addition to the two regular scheduled 12-hour commercial fishing periods, additional time is allowed, and this additional time is dependent upon the run size. Essentially, the bigger the run, the more fishing time is allowed. An in-river goal is different than an escapement goal in that the in-river goals includes allocations of sockeye salmon for the sport fishery above the sonar site, which is located at mile 19. At that site, there is an amount of sockeye salmon added to the escapement goal that provides for harvest above the sonar site for in-river users. The late run Kenai plan has established goals based upon the expected run size. If the Kenai River sockeye salmon run is going to be small, or less than 2.3 million sockeye salmon, then there is one goal. If the run is between 2.3 and 4.6 million sockeye salmon, there is a second goal that adds more fish to the in-river users. And then if it's over 4.6 million, there is a third goal, which even provides more fish to the in-river users. The drift fishery occurs in the central district as well as in the various sections that I outlined earlier. The central district is also divided up into four drift areas. Drift fishermen do not necessarily get to fish the entire central district. There are certain time periods and specific areas when and where drift fishermen can go. Again, as I mentioned earlier, at this recent board meeting in February 2014, action was taken in the drift fishery. From July 9 to July 15, drifters are restricted to the expanded corridor and drift gillnet area 1 during the regular fishing periods during this time frame. From July 16 through July 31, in runs of less than 2.3 million Kenai River sockeye salmon, all regular 12-hour fishing periods are restricted to the expanded Kenai and expanded Kasilof sections of the upper sub-district. For runs between 2.3 and 4.6 million sockeye salmon to the Kenai River, one regular fishing period per week is restricted to any combination of those sections on the right-hand side and area 1, which you see on the left-hand side. The second period is restricted to any combination of the east side sections only. In runs of over 4.6 million sockeye salmon to the Kenai River between July 16 and 31, only one fishing period per week is restricted to the east side sections shown on the right, and then there is no restriction for the second period in that week. Additional fishing time that's allowed to the drift fishery is restricted to the east side net sections described here on the right. The Northern District Salmon Management Plan directs the department to manage the harvest of Northern District chum, pink, and sockeye salmon primarily for commercial uses, to minimize the harvest of Northern District coho salmon, and to provide for sport and guided sport opportunity. This is accomplished by not allowing additional commercial fishing periods if coho are thought to be the most abundant stock in that particular harvest. The Northern District is also limited to the regular 12-hour fishing periods on Mondays and Thursdays after August 15. The Susitna River sockeye salmon was declared to be a stock concern at the yield level in 2008 and is managed by the action plan that was developed at that time. Guidelines are regular fishing periods only between June 25 and July 19, and then between July 20 and August 6, only one net may be used. However, if escapement goals aren't being met, additional nets can be used. The Susitna River sockeye salmon, as I mentioned before, are a stock of yield concern. Essentially, what this means is that escapement goals have been met, but the yield, i.e. the harvest from fishermen, has declined. This map shows the three sockeye salmon goals that are now monitored by weirs. The first is Chilatna, which is part of the Yentna River drainage, as well as Judd Lake. Larson Lake is part of the main stem Susitna River. Beginning in 2009, the Yentna River sockeye salmon escapement goal, which was based on a Bendix sonar and fish wheel apportionment study, was replaced by the three Lake Weir goals. These two lakes here represent approximately 42% of the sockeye salmon migrating into the Yetna River. The Chilatna Lake goal is 20,000 to 65,000 fish, and this goal was achieved or exceeded in four of the past 5 years. In the below graph, Judd Lake sockeye salmon, the goal there is 25,000 to 55,000 sockeye, and it has been achieved or exceeded in two of the past 5 years, but not achieved in 3 years. Larson Lake, through tagging studies, indicate that it approximately is one half of the main stem Susitna River. The escapement goal is 15,000 to 50,000 fish, and the goal at Larson Lake has been achieved in four of the past 5 years. To summarize the management plans that we've just talked about, these plans are complex by themselves and how they interact with each other, meaning how actions taken in one plan may affect actions of another plan. Carrying out these plans in season requires coordination and communication between the two management divisions. In years of low abundance with any species, this coordination typically includes directors. Meeting the escapement goals are the primary objective of all of our management plans. The department has been clear that meeting the lower end of a goal has a priority of not exceeding the upper end of another escapement goal. Again, as I previously talked about, these management plans are structured by the migratory timing of these stocks as they move into and through Cook Inlet. They also include step-down plans that provide specific management objectives to the department for both management and allocation in each of those fisheries.
This committee has already had a presentation on the Chinook Salmon Research Initiative, but we wanted to take this opportunity to highlight important research activities that are ongoing as it pertains to Chinook salmon. In the Susitna River drainage, we have projects that are currently using other funding sources, such as Susitna-Watonna or Alaska Energy Authority, a CIP that was derived in 2014, and AKSSSF, which is Alaska Sustainable Salmon Funds. These projects include looking at adult spawning abundance, juvenile abundance, Cook Inlet area harvests, genetic stock identification, and coated wire tagging, and local and traditional knowledge. In the Kenai River, we already have a fair amount of research being conducted. The new sonar, which I will speak to in a little bit, but we will also be looking at Kenai River Kings in the Cook Inlet area in terms of harvests and apportionment of those harvests using genetics and coated wire tagging of juveniles.
This map depicts some of the new major projects being conducted for sockeye, king, and coho salmon. I will apologize, I don't have transitions, so I'll kind of walk you through this. These include the three Lake Weirs previously mentioned, and these are the two dots at the top and one at the left in the middle. The sockeye salmon fish wheel project continues to operate on the Susitna River right at the branch where the Yetna comes in. And we're trying to find a feasible means to reestablish the sonar to better manage these stocks. Also in that same location, a chum, king, and coho salmon mark recapture studies are being done to evaluate the total run of these stocks. To the red dot on the right and kind of in the middle, a Fish Creek sockeye salmon smolt project studies out migrants to help department better understand its life cycle, which also provides greater detail for forecasting run strength. The next couple of projects I will highlight here, I will talk in more detail after this slide. Throughout Cook Inlet, genetic sampling is a critical part of any mixed stock fishery, not only to determine how many fish were caught, but to find out where those fish were going. The Kenai Kasilof River sonar projects are the oblong circle down at the bottom. And then the anchor point test fisheries, which I'll, as I mentioned earlier, I'll touch on here in just a minute. Genetic stock identification provides the department an estimation for the stock harvested in a mixed stock fishery. This information, along with escapement information, allows us to more accurately estimate escapement goals. It also allows us to gain information on how stocks move through Cook Inlet across time and area. Another project allows us to go back in time to analyze, using genetics, historical information which improves brood tables used to determine escapement goals. And also that may allow us to determine how big run sizes were historically. We have a postseason stock identification project which improves our total estimation for each stock harvested in mixed stock fisheries. Using genetics provides a more robust escapement goal analysis. It also separates the Kenai Kasilof and other stocks that might be harvested in the Eastside Set Gill Net fisheries. We are currently developing a new genetic baseline for Upper Cook Inlet coho salmon. This is a new project and the first time for the species using coho genetics in a mixed stock fisheries. This is necessary to understand the total run, which is catch and escapement in these fisheries. Post-season stock identification of coho salmon is a three-year project. And again, it will improve the understanding, the overall stock-specific assessment of coho salmon. The anchor point line test fishery has been in place since 1979, providing run timing and abundance of sockeye salmon that are moving into Upper Cook Inlet. This project has been a key factor in providing in season the total run. Having this information allows the department to do an in-season projection, and if we need to, we can make adjustments to our management plans in season. A northern drift test fishery began in 2012, funded by a capital improvement project for 5 years. This next year will be the third year of that project. Besides sockeye salmon, coho salmon genetic samples are being collected to determine their river of origin. This is the first coho genetic study ever done in Upper Cook Inlet. Also, not quite so old, but certainly worth mentioning, is a multi-year study that we began in Region 2 to implement a new sonar called DITSON, which is dual frequency identification sonar. This new sonar counts more fish and counts them accurately, therefore providing us better information on escapements. The Kenai of this study of this portion began in 2004, and the Kasilof began in 2006. The Bendix counter, which on your screen is to the left, the silver box, is an echo counting single beam sonar with 2 and 4 degree circular beams. The information we got from this machine was essentially a ticker tape that we would add numbers on. In the middle is the DITSON that I previously mentioned with a multi-beam sonar and a 29 degree field of view and either 8 or 14 degree vertical beams. As you can see, don't have a movie here, but you can actually visually see fish moving through the sonar beam, which provides a more accurate information. And this also allows us to archive these video for future studies. And pertaining to the Bendix DITSON replacement, just a quick slide to show the difference between or how much better the DITSON is counting these fish than Bendix.
There are a suite of stock assessment or escapement enumeration projects conducted by Sportfish Division staff represented on this map by solid dots. The open circles depict genetic stock identification sampling locations within the marine recreational fishery, the Eastside Set Net fishery, and also within the Northern District Set Net and Tionic subsistence fisheries. We have broken these escapement projects out into two broad categories representing long-standing or greater than 10 years in duration projects depicted here, and those that have been added in the last several years depicted in the next slide. Moving south to north, there are the Anchor River, Chinook Salmon Weir, and then the next two, which are the Nanilchik and Crooked Chinook Salmon Weirs in broodstock collection sites. Noteworthy is that within our array of escapement enumeration or indexing processes, both within Cook Inlet and statewide, a weir is the most precise means of measuring escapement, and along with sonar, are the most costly. whereas aerial and foot surveys are the least costly and imprecise, hence why we often refer to them as escapement indices. That is, that it's some unknown fraction or a poorly quantified fraction of the total escapement. The systems in Milchick, Crooked, and Deception Creek weirs are also employed for enhancement activities or broodstock collection, whereby we take eggs at those sites that are transported to the William Jack Hatchery in Anchorage for rearing and subsequent release. This is a listing of more recent projects, those that have been conducted for less than 5 years in their current form, that have been added either through CIP funds, increments, or contractual funds such as those from Alaska Energy Authority or Sustainable Salmon Funds. In the case of both the Lewis and Theodore weirs, we were able to extend these weir operations to count coho salmon owing to the cost savings of already having these weirs established for counting Chinook. The Alexander Creek project listed here, or the control project, was started in 2008 as a pilot netting program. And with this information, we've been able to secure funds from AKSSF to expand the program, and now with a legislative increment, we'll be able to move from aerial survey to counting Chinook and coho salmon via weir. Before moving on, I would like to highlight the Susitna River project that in 2013, for the first time, staff have been able to estimate drainage-wide escapements of both Chinook and coho salmon. In 2013, there were approximately 89,000 Chinook and 160,000 coho that escaped into this drainage. This project will continue in 2014 as part of AEA, and then the Chinook salmon component will be funded using Chinook Salmon Research Initiative funds moving into the future. We will also be embarking on a number of habitat-related projects using funds appropriated from the legislature, which include inventorying of beaver dams for future removal, finishing a problem culvert inventory and replacement program, and prioritizing a wetlands habitat inventory for the Mat-Su. These funds were provided via CIP to the department. The department has used sonar technology, as Tracy had mentioned earlier, on the Kenai River for a lengthy period of time to try and, or as a means to count king salmon on the Kenai. The new Ditson or ARIS technology allows us to improve our precision of counting Chinook salmon over previous techniques. A CIP of $1.8 million in FY13 has allowed us to conduct activities such as conducting two sonar sites, both at 8.6 mile and 13.7 river mile. The 13.7 miles above tidal influence. We've conducted mark recapture and radio tracking fish to further refine and improve our escapement enumeration program. 2013 was the first year of paired counts, and we anticipate with several more years of paired counts being able to move our sonar program to mile 13.7, which is above tidal influence and improves our estimates. As I briefly touched on in an earlier slide, we have a number of enhancement projects for Chinook and coho salmon within Cook Inlet. By enhancement, I mean we have sites where we take eggs, incubate, and rear the fish to the smolt stage, and then release them into the ocean environment. These fish come back and support a variety of marine and freshwater sport fisheries. One thing to point out with this slide is that we received funds from the legislature in 2013 specific to the Mat-Su for increased production of Chinook salmon at Deception and Eklutna Tail Race. At both of these locations, as you can see from the table above, for the first two entries on that table, that we've increased markedly the number of fish that we're projecting to release in 2014. The new William Jack Hernandez hatchery has allowed us to increase both the quantity as well as the quality as measured by weight and grams of these fish. We believe that right around 14 grams is about the optimum size for Chinook salmon smolt releases, and hence why you see a slight reduction in size, which is the lower bar, or the line above the bars on the bottom tab. And that, in essence, is allowing us to turn around and trying to get smolt to adult survival at an optimum level. And this particular map showing the release sites or the enhancement activities that we have around Cook Inlet, and I won't walk through them, but as you can see, there's quite a variety of them in various stages. Madam Chairman, Senate Resource Committee members, this concludes our lengthy but certainly in real-time abbreviated presentation of Cook Inlet Salmon Management and Department activities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for the presentation. So, committee members, questions? Looks like we have lots of sticky notes on our different pages. I have several myself. Senator Machiki, would you like to start out?
Yeah, if I could do a couple, and then you won't get tired of hearing from me. Maybe we can come back later.
But, sure.
Yes, couple. One key question. Well, I don't want to say key question. You mentioned the riparian management plans. Pretty involved in this issue. I'm just trying to. Are you talking about the sustainable salmon management plan? Which riparian management plan is it you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Senator Machiki. There's elements within the management plans that are dealing with in-river that have a riparian habitat component to them. I think that what you were first referring to was the Sustainable Salmon Fisheries Management Policy, which is a board policy that has habitat components in it. What we were referring to here is that there's riparian habitat components within some of these plans that instruct the department to, in one case, to present to the board activities that have taken place in the riparian habitat and present that to the board at a regular cycle meeting.
Follow up on that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair. So are we still doing, did we sort of, and I remember the old Mary King studies, repeat aerial photography stuff. Do we still do any of those for comparisons of kind of before and after?
Madam Chair, Senator Machiki, no, we haven't done any of late. We're morely focused on those areas that appear to be impacted by recreational anglers, and I think the board actually instructed a couple areas additional to close to recreational anglers along the banks, but we haven't done any intensive work in that regard.
Okay, thank you.
So Tracy and Charlie, you're both fish biologists. Am I correct about that? What exactly are your credentials? I don't mean that in a negative way. I just don't know.
Do you want to start?
Madam Chair, I have a background in zoology is what my college degree is. But with the state of Alaska, my career began in 1985. I essentially have spent 13 years working on the Yukon in a suite of positions, and I've been in spent 7 years in Kotzebue assisting that fishery. And really, in a sense, although I came to Cook Inlet in 2005, compared to most folks, I'm a newbie. So that's my background.
I have the undergraduate training or Bachelor of Science in biology with an emphasis on aquatic ecology. I have a Bachelor of Science in fishery science with an emphasis on statistics. And I have a master's degree in fishery science with an emphasis on salmon population dynamics and statistics. And I've worked since I had hair on my head, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So following up on that then, these fishery plans, are you the folks that write them, you and your other staff, or is it the Board of Fish? I mean, you're the scientists, right?
Madam Chairman, that is correct. These management plans, elements of them are in essence put in place with consultation with the board and the department. In a lot of cases it's a back and forth, if you will, and you know, by and large, relying on the department to answer the simple question, can you manage this fishery with these elements or those sorts of things? So it's a collaborative effort, I guess you could say.
Do you ever feel like, I guess I shouldn't be asking about your feelings, but are your recommendations typically taken by the board, or does the board have its own ideas most of the time? I mean, would you feel free to characterize that? Maybe you wouldn't.
Madam Chair, I'd characterize it. It's I'd say it depends on the board, and it's a little bit of both.
Okay. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have yet to catch a king, and I've been in Alaska for over 50 years. So I understand. And I say that because I'm in the rivers occasionally, but not a lot, fishing. Can you talk to me about the habits of pike in some of the presentations that we've had over this past week about learning more about our rivers and streams? It has been at least alluded to that pike are causing quite a bit of the problems, at least in the Matsu area and some of those drainages. And I don't know if that fish migrates. I just don't know about northern pike. I know more about salmon, and I haven't caught a king, but I've caught plenty of reds. So can you help me out on what happens with the pikes and what we're doing?
Madam Chair, Senator Fairclough, I'll do my best. First and foremost, pike, by and large, are not endemic to systems on the south side of the Alaska Range. Based upon backtracking and whatnot, pike were first introduced in the late 1950s, early 1960s, in what I would characterize as a pothole lake in the Matsu, in the drainage. Over the course of time, through flooding, pike spawning habitat is generally shallow being, you know, under 4 or 5 feet, reedy or, you know, aquatic sedge vegetation that warms up relatively quickly in the springtime. So when you see systems that have those generally characteristics, they would be favorable towards pike spawning and juvenile rearing. What we believe is that through flooding events, high water events, pike will move. They move, they have seasonal movements where they tend to move into more of a deep basins for overwintering in the wintertime. They will, in fact, move from lake systems down into river systems where there's a steady flow, such as what they do up in the interior. They'll move into some of the larger river systems to overwinter, and then they'll move back into these spawning areas, and in some cases even underneath the ice in the spring, and prepare themselves for spawning. They're generally very voracious. They're cannibalistic. And pretty much will eat anything that'll move. In the case of Alexander Creek, what we've been working on there, that used to be a fairly large, high-profile Chinook and coho salmon fishery back in the day. Pike, in terms of Alexander Lake, that lake is a relatively shallow basin, plenty of weeds. Premium pike spawning habitat. What we've been focused on is some of the sloughs and other areas where those pike will spawn and then move. And what we've been doing is an intensive netting program and blocking off those things and catching the pike and disposing them. And we've seen some positive, encouraging signs with regards to that project, but it's a pretty intensive project. I'm not sure we're ever going to completely be able to eradicate them from that system, but with a controlled effort, we should be able to, and we've actually already started to see signs where distribution of Chinook and Coho juveniles has gone to where we haven't seen it in a handful of years in the past. There's another fairly intensive project that we're working on the Kenai Peninsula on Soldotna Creek, where we're working on, there's a series of interconnected lakes, and we're taking a different approach there, whereby we're using rotenone, which is essentially a toxicant to fish anyway. And we've got to go through it in a fairly systematic fashion because those lakes are interconnected. And so it's a little bit more of an involved process, but we're hopeful that we'll be successful in that and possibly take that approach to other areas up in the Mat-Su.
Yes.
Well, a couple questions. So, Mr. Swanton, is that correct? So they move, but they don't move. They don't go out into open water. They stay pretty much in the systems, but move to deeper water, or do they actually go between fresh water and salt water?
Madam Chair, Senator Fairclough. You know, there have been reports of them moving in salt water in brackish waters. I don't know to what extent and to what sort of frequency they do that, but by and large, most of their migrations are between and within a drainage. But obviously, there's been some movement in brackish waters, but I can't tell you to how much of it and how frequent it is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me how long the poison has to be in the water for it to affect the pike?
Madam Chair, Senator Fairclough, I really can't, you know, in terms of duration and whatever else, I don't think that it's all that long, but in some cases there's repeated applications simply because of wanting to make sure that the rotenone has fairly constant or comprehensive mixing and takes care of it, especially when you're dealing with littoral areas where they're relatively shallow. But I can't tell you. I can certainly get the answer for you if you'd like.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Do we typically go after, if we're trying to eradicate pike from a system to try to protect salmon, do we typically do that in winter or summer? Or can you tell me?
Issue. Madam Chair, Senator Fairclough, we generally make these applications in the fall.
Madam Chair, where I was going is it doesn't sound, I wouldn't think it sounds good to most Alaskans to put poison in the water, period. But, people do want salmon runs to continue and pike, at least. Certainly were alluded to earlier this week as part of the problem. And so what I was thinking about, when Alaska freezes half of its water during the winter, it seems like we could find the pools of where they might be wintering in deeper water and try to do something during a winter time when most of our water would be not exposed to the chemicals. We'd have less to put in, and we could contain a drainage system a little bit easier when you didn't have so much flow going through it. And I just was wondering if the science, I'm sure I'm way behind someone else thinking about that, but I just was wondering, in an effort to protect our water and our salmon, if there was a way to go after those pesky pike during the winter.
Madam Chair, Senator Flitkoff, we can certainly provide you with a wealth of detailed information as to how the applications are, what the concentrations of the applications are, how many times they're repeated, how successful that they are. And I just wanted to make one point, is that rotenone isn't necessarily poisonous to human beings. It affects essentially oxygen transfer in the fish's gills, and they essentially cease breathing.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that clarification. I apologize. Thank you.
So just following on that rotenone, so what we've heard from the aquaculture folks is that they capture the native species of salmon and take them to hatcheries, right, or set them aside and then apply the rotenone. When can you restock with the native species in a rotenone-treated water body?
Madam Chair, you would do it as soon as you felt comfortable that all the pike had been removed from the system. Otherwise, you've kind of defeated the purpose.
So you don't have in a general period of time, like a year later, 2 years later, you just kind of assess the situation?
Madam Chair, that is correct. I mean, it could be as much as, the first thing that you'd want to do is make sure that you were successful in eradicating the pike out of that system. Typically that's done with various traps, so on and so forth. You may do it in the spring, figuring that there might be a few fish that are kicking around. You might do a follow-up that fall. You might do a follow-up the following spring. It all depends on how comfortable you are with, the habitat, the size of the lake, and all of those sorts of characteristics. But that would be the general approach, is that once you were, once you were sure that, that you had taken care of the pike, that you'd reintroduce those, whether it be salmon or whether it be resident species for that matter.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bishop had some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Charlie, I want you to do some myth busting for me. So, how much is there any transplant of pike from birds, from migratory waterfowl? Have you heard that? I mean, I've heard that. Is that fact or fiction?
Madam Chair, Senator Bishop, if I'd have known that I was going to get into a myth-busting exercise this afternoon, I might have been a little bit broader prepared for some of the questions that are posed. There's a number of vectors that people have postulated with regards to invasive species, with regards to small aquatic organisms and whatnot. Some of the things would be, okay, let's say a migratory bird happened to be in a shallow habitat, happened to get a couple. I mean, pike eggs, like other, eggs are relatively adhesive.
But
I would say that it's possible. I don't know if I could give you a definitive answer, yes or no, so that I could, I guess bust that myth, Senator.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think you answered my question earlier, if I remember right, is that the pike were stocked in the 50s. Did I hear that? In one lake, and that's...
Madam Chair, Senator Bishop, that's... I believe that we've got some documentation from some of our earlier work that had tracked it back to that period in time. So, I mean, plus or minus a few years, I believe it was the late 50s, early 60s.
Just one more quick one, and I'll leave the pike
alone.
Yes,
Senator Bishop.
There's a lot of people that live in where these pike are. All I can tell you from experiences from the interior, we had a river called the Chattanooga River, and in the wintertime, it got pretty aggressive on the fishing, and the pike fishing almost went to nil. I'm looking for a little save back there from my staffer, but The Fairbanks people really enjoy ice fishing and fishing over jigs and really going after the pike to the point where we were too efficient at it. So do they winter fish down here, do we know, or?
Madam Chair, Senator Bishop, I believe I've certainly observed some of the interior's pike fishing on the Chattanooga River. And one of the concerns with regards to that particular fishery is that during certain periods of time, those folks were taking some pretty large fish, and those large fish happened to be females, and preparation for spawning. And when you're taking large females out of a population that are in fairly concentrated waters, you, depending upon the rate at which you do that, you can get into some problems pretty quickly. There are a number of folks in the Mat-Su that do ice fish. There's been a number of, I know that they had a derby out there at one point in time, ice fishing derby for pike. But there's a fair amount of activity, but there's also quite a few spots that have got quite a few pike in them.
Thank you. Senator Machiki?
Sure, if you don't mind. And Charlie and Tracy, you guys, you do an amazing job. I understand you have limited funding. There's only so much you can do for studies, but none of my questions are negative. They're just questions, okay? So through the chair, we just wondering if during the Board of Fish meetings, we talked about net reduction and shallow gear, but does the board now have the ability to introduce more Eastside set net areas so that the department can actually fish people when fish are on the beach in that locale as they move up the beach? Or are you still currently just east of Blanchard or north of Blanchard, south of Blanchard, or the whole district?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, as you noted, our fisheries are split between the Kenai and Kusilov section. And after July 8th, those two sections are married. Just because that those two sections are married does not necessarily mean that we may manage them together. For instance, if we're short on Kenai River king salmon or even sockeye salmon, we may choose to fish the Kusilov section but not the Kenai section. By regulation, the department has time and area. And so even though the regulations state you will manage these areas together, there are times when we actually have to reduce sections like we've done in the last couple of years in order to harvest one species and try to ensure another species makes it to their spawning ground.
Okay. You have to follow up, Madam
Yes,
Chair. Unless you stop me, I've got several. So.
Please, go ahead.
So you don't have, you're currently, this plan does not allow subdividing the Kenai or Kusilov sections.
Subdividing the sections as to smaller areas than those sections? That would be correct.
Okay. Through the chair, ma'am?
Yes.
So, okay, another question. So we talked about, now my understanding other than spatial and temporal distribution was that coho genetics were not stream specific. So I remember back in the 80s they did the different studies where they seined stocks in the lower inlet, tagged them, and what they knew, I'm thinking about the anchor point section, what we know is that wherever they seined fish, those fish could be seined anywhere in the lower inlet and can return to any stream in the upper inlet. They weren't sort of directionally organized that low in the inlet. Am I misunderstanding, or is there actually an individual genetic code for rivers of origin for coho and Cook Inlet?
Madam Chair, Senator Machiki, I believe Bill Templin is on the line. He is the runs our genetics lab. The department's genetics lab, and if he's available, I'd certainly like to have him answer that question.
Bill, can you hear us?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Bill Templin, the principal geneticist for the department's genetics lab.
Well,
sorry.
Welcome. Did you hear Senator Machiki's question?
I did. Senator Machiki and Madam Chair, there is a significant amount of genetic diversity in coho salmon in Cook Inlet. It's not necessarily always down to the individual stream, but it does seem to be organized around larger drainages. Our initial work on coho salmon genetics in Cook Inlet indicated that there's sufficient amount of genetic distinction among these larger population groups that it could be used for identification of proportional contribution to harvest in Cook Inlet. And we're currently working on that right now.
Okay, thank you.
And follow-up, Senator Machiki?
And where I was going is in the anchor point section. Were you asked by the board about potential conflicts with the halibut charter fleet in latter July in the anchor point section where hundreds of charter boats are going to have interactions where they previously had few with drift gill netters?
Madam Chair, Senator Machiki, I can't speak for staff. I personally was not asked that, but there certainly was a wide array of folks that fish in the marine waters in and around that area that were in the audience and attending that board meeting. So if that was a concern to the board, or certainly think that there were folks around that could have addressed that.
Okay. Someone else have questions? I have a couple.
Senator French, did you have a question?
I did. Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. It's related to slide, I think, 16. You had that chart of the creeks with the low escapements in slide 16. And I'm just wondering, I'll take one in the middle. Goose Creek has a goal of 250 to 650 escapement. In 2009 was 65, 2010, 76, 2011.
Excuse me, Senator French, could you pull your microphone? There you go.
Oh, thanks, Madam Chair. Very low escapement there in Goose Creek. I'm again, slide 16, Goose Creek escapement. I hate to ask an open-ended question, but what do we do? I mean, what turns that around? What's the long-term picture for folks like myself that aren't biologists or aren't experts? You know, when I go home, what do I tell my folks that the department or the board is doing to fix that?
Madam Chair, Senator French, in essence, the board and in situations like this, they take a look at what fisheries are inducing mortality on that stock, whether it be a sport fishery, a personal use fishery, subsistence fishery, commercial fishery, and they take a look at that, and in consultation with the department, they figure out where the mortality exists in terms of harvest, and they do whatever they can to minimize or diminish that. Beyond that, in terms of Chinook salmon over the course of the last 6 or 8 years, I mean, what we've been experiencing almost statewide has been what we believe to be poor ocean rearing conditions for Chinook salmon, at least for Alaska stocks. And in essence, there's not a lot we can do about it other than we can do our best to make sure that we meet the escapement objectives that we've laid out for these stocks and wait for those production regime to shift, and it has occurred in the past, and it probably will occur in the future. Madam Chair.
Just one follow-up. I mean, as I was listening to the presentation, it seemed like the one tool we have is commercial closures for kingfishing, but there just aren't many of them left. I mean, it sounds like they're very, very small. Besides that, I mean, what I heard you say was we're hoping that the ocean conditions change to produce more salmon coming back. Is that I think I'm oversimplifying, so don't let me oversimplify.
Madam Chair, Senator French, In essence, when I refer to ocean conditions, what I'm talking about is forage and temperature and production that are favorable for Chinook salmon. And in essence, I'll give you an example. I mean, right now, I mean, with a wide variety of Chinook salmon stocks, we're probably looking at a smolt to adult survival of somewhere around less than 1% to right around 1%, whereas in more favorable conditions, we'd be looking at somewhere between 3% and 5% smolt to adult survival. So you can turn around and take a look at the numbers on that table, or take a look at the numbers that were in the enhancement component, and realize that we could go from producing 1,500 fish to producing as many as 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 adults with the same levels of escapement. And that's kind of the general orders that we're dealing with right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say for the record that I did once catch a nice sized king salmon. Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a long time ago.
Senator Bishop.
Just to dovetail on Senator French, mm-hmm. It's just more of an observation, because I love what you guys do. I mean, I just love the fish. I think all Alaskans like fish. And so we're keenly in tune of the resource. But I was watching a special on the Columbia River and all the hatcheries that they have on the Columbia, and that 1% for all the eggs that they put in, smolt to go back in the river, it's a 1% return for all the eggs. You know, that's what I saw on the program. I don't know if that's accurate or not, or if you've ever seen it, but it's interesting to hear you say that 1% on Goose Creek, and then for all the millions of eggs and they do in the Columbia, that's what they get for a return. Just a comment.
Madam Chair, Senator Bishop, I believe when they were talking about 1% in terms of those hatcheries, they were talking about an egg to a subsequent adult. One thing that, for comparative purposes right now, I mean, those fish that are being produced in the Columbia's, and those stocks are having almost, or they did last year, and it appears that they're going to have again this year, record returns of adults. And that's kind of converse to the situation that we have up here in Alaska. And those are the sorts of things that it's, a teeter-totter, if you will. Those balances shift back and forth between north and south.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Following up on the Columbia River, I'm not sure who commissioned this study, but an organization in British Columbia was tagging the fish and actually following them back to their home streams. And the company was here in Cook Inlet last summer. Was that department ADF&G, or was that one of the fishery organizations that was doing that study to actually see the tracking of the kings as they came up the shore, and did they go above the Kenai River before turning back into it? I mean, these were questions that were going to be determined or possibly answered. Do you know?
Madam Chair, you were referring to the study that was done by Katama, and that was they were more or less a sonic tag, and in essence, they tagged a number of, and that was through contract with the Department of Fish and Game. And that was both for distribution as well in terms of migration through a wide arrays in Cook Inlet, and that was done for 1 year. Some of the work that's done elsewhere, almost coast-wide, is and it was referenced in our presentation with regard to coded wire tagging, which in essence has been a long-standing approach to tag smolts or juveniles, and you put an alphanumeric code, coded piece of wire into their snout, and then you clip their adipose fin, which is a fleshy fin at the right before you get to the dorsal or the tail fin. And that's how you'd identify that those fish have coated wire tags. And in that coated wire tag recovery, you're able to determine when that fish was released, when it was tagged, and what river of origin it was. And you can do that at pretty much any point near ocean migration. And that's been done for a lengthy period of time, and that's how, in essence, we have the migratory pathways that those fish have in the ocean is through that means.
So just to follow up on that, what did you learn from the one-year study that was contracted?
Madam Chair, I think that some of the things that we suspected were verified with a limited amount of empirical data, that being that king salmon tend to mill in the ocean in and around the mouths of their natal streams more so than do other species, and that sockeye are more directional. And I believe that the other main theme was that king salmon tend to travel deeper than sockeye salmon in terms of vertically in the water column.
So did that inform the guidance then for the set netters in terms of having their nets higher, different net size? I mean, was it fruitful in terms of management?
Madam Chair, and not to be glib about the answer to this, but I think that you'd have to ask the Board of Fisheries. In some cases, I do know that we had a task force that was a precursor to this board meeting of about a year and a half ago about talking about, what restrictions could both the sport fishery, commercial, and personal use fisheries bring to the board, that it was a precursor to the board. And I do know that there were certain representatives of the set netters that were talking about shallower nets at that point in time, which would have been precursive to any of the information that came from the study. But I can't tell you definitively where the board was at in terms of that information versus some of the specific requests that came from SetNet groups.
Okay, thank you. Senator Machicki.
Well, let's stay on this, on Chinook for species, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. And just, Mr. Swanton, the sample size, pretty low in that study. Would you agree with that? Successfully tagged, was it under 10?
Madam Chair, Senator Machicki, I don't have the numbers of samples in my head from that, but it was certainly limited compared to other tagging studies that have been done. I don't know whether they met their sampling sampling objectives or not. I had 78 kicking around in my head, but maybe Tracy could bail me out.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the project when it began was to tag 70 sockeye salmon and 70 Chinook salmon. I believe there were 51 sockeye salmon tagged and then 25 Chinook salmon tagged.
Okay. Follow up?
Yes, please, Senator Machicki.
We talked a little bit, and my history is I hope we're working to ensure that all user groups in Cook Inlet, and we know about times of low abundance, and we know that's going to turn around sometime. We'll have large supplies one day of king salmon, but I hope that's everyone's objective, and that includes valley fish, that includes sport and commercial and personal use. But we talked a little bit, and Senator next to me talked a little bit about the commercial limitations, and I think in times of low abundance, everyone has to be restricted that intercepts those fish. Let's talk about the nearly extinct early run, the Slycock, Beaver, and Killy tributaries. What are you as concerned as I am, and what do you see as some realistic solutions to ensure that every fish survives until those times of adequate abundance return?
Madam Chair, Senator Machicki, I think it's pretty clear what the department is that, you know, we've already announced that we're going to close the early run completely. So I don't know how much more reduction of mortality you'd expect out of the department, and I don't necessarily believe that there's really that much precursive mortality in the marine environment by any user group at that point in time. So it is a matter of just doing our best to let them be. And
if I may, I very much support that decision. I think you've made the right decision there, and I think it's a good one. When we talk about the sustainable salmon fisheries policy, and you know, my goal is to help any way I can to make sure that those fisheries in the valley that are currently challenged return to adequate productivity at some point. But let's just say there may be some habitat challenges. Who is managing the riparian zone's water quality and water quantity in some of those streams? And the reason I ask that is because we had a similar water quality issue on the Kenai a few years back, and we had a lot of agencies. It was difficult to get an agency to say, yes, by golly, we have a hydrocarbon problem, we're going to work on this. Who is responsible for the water quality in areas that could be affecting abundance?
Madam Chair, Senator Machicki, DEC is the agency that has been involved with regards to hydrocarbons and turbidity and designations specifically with regards to the Kenai and the Little Sioux.
Madam Chair, follow
yes,
up.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
We're getting close to five, so I'll start going to just my priority ones. But do you see a gap, and do you would, and I won't ask you, I don't want to put you on the spot. I know you guys want what's best for fish. That is, I have no doubt in my mind. I think there's a gap, but just me. But will you at least consider a system where agencies work toward those objectives that have shared responsibilities in the future? And I'll follow up with the outside of this meeting, but I think there's a gap. And I've witnessed that gap, and I've seen what great things can happen when the agencies do sort of say, well, okay, we may not care whose purview it is. This is an issue, and we're going to work on it. Do you think there's some room for improvement?
Madam Chair, Senator Machicki, maybe I might take you up on that offer after we're done here.
Okay, that's fair. Thank you.
Anything further, Senator Machicki?
No, ma'am. Thank you very much.
That was other questions? Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much, Charlie and Tracy, for joining us today in your presentation. So this ends Fish Week. I think it's been really informative. At least I've certainly enjoyed it and learned a lot. I think we had some great, diverse presentations. Our meeting tomorrow is canceled. I know all the committee members have been notified, but anyone in the public who's listening. Our next meeting will be on Seward Day, Monday, the 31st. And appropriately, we're going to be talking about opportunities for resource development to address economic challenges in rural Alaska, particularly. Seward's main reason for the purchase of Alaska from Russia, of course, was the economic opportunities. Senator Machicki, did you want to add something?
Before you gavel out, I'd like to say one thing. Madam mm-hmm. Chair, I just want to on the record praise you for this week. And again, I've been kind of following these issues for a long time, and this is the most concentrated, all user groups across the board, most concentrated effort I've seen to get good information out to Alaskans. I just want to thank you personally for that.
Thank you, Senator Machuki. I think we all have enjoyed it a lot. So, but in any case, we'll meet again on Monday, Seward's Day, usual time, 3:30. So at this time, I'll adjourn. The time is 4:58 p.m. Thank you.